This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, if Roe v. Wade is in fact overturned, what will women do to maintain sovereignty over their own bodies? What will a post-Roe world mean for women's reproductive health? The way issues are framed influences attitudes and opinions. What frames advance rights related to reproductive choice? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. As the U.S. Supreme Court indicates its likelihood of overturning the landmark decision that enshrines women's reproductive control over their bodies, Roe v. Wade, women throughout the country are wrestling with strategies to ensure continued abilities to terminate unwanted pregnancies. This legal development has been anticipated. The drastic shift to the right of the court has for years compelled abortion advocates to develop alternative strategies for women. On today's show, we explore how women will ensure access to abortion and reproductive sovereignty post-Roe. Our guests today are Rachel Rebouchet, the interim dean of Temple University's Beasley School of Law and the James E. Beasley Professor of Law. She's the author of a new piece, The New Abortion Battleground. Lena Maria Murillo, assistant professor at the University of Iowa. She is the author of Fighting for Control, Power, Reproductive Care, and Race in the U.S.-Mexico Borderlands. And Robin Marty, the communications director for the West Alabama Women's Center and a freelance reporter. She's the author of Handbook for a Post-Roe America and co-author of The End of Roe v. Wade. Thank you all for joining us. I'll start with Lena Marie Murillo. A lot of the conversation at this point about what America is going to look like post-Roe is signaled by what America looked like pre-Roe. So first of all, how much is a 2022 post-Roe America basically going to reflect what, you know, pre-1973, pre-Roe America looked like with women trying to gain access to, you know, to reproductive sovereignty?
Thanks, Doug, for that question. So on the one hand, it will look similar to the years just before Roe, in that there are states currently that are seeking to codify access to abortion, right? So California, New York, Illinois, Colorado. And those are some of the states that, you know, early on in the push to make abortion access easier for people in the late 1960s had done similar things, right? So they'd liberalized some of their abortion statutes. However, at the time, there were not necessarily ideas floating around about curtailing people's access to moving to get access to abortion, right? And so the borderlands of abortion in the years before Roe, people could travel to different states to get abortions. They could travel outside of the country, right? Most of my scholarship is focused on people traveling to the U.S.-Mexico border region, to Mexico, northern Mexico, specifically. But you know, we see states that are anticipating this right now and saying, you know, maybe we should pass laws making it so that people cannot travel outside the confines of their state to access reproductive care, such as abortion. This brings in, you know, this is what reproductive justice advocates say is like, you know, abortion is just the tip of the iceberg. You have all of these other systems at play, right? The carceral state, and the police state, the surveillance state, surveilling people. So you have a lot of folks talking about, you know, delete your period app on your phone so that the, you know, people can't track this kind of information and this data, and they can't track you. It's a new landscape in that, you know, technology has made it easier to surveil people, and the fact that states are thinking about denying people not only, you know, sovereignty over their bodies, but also the right to movement is mind-blowing, truly.
And Rachel Rebouchet, one question is, how is that legal? Being able to deny people to be able to travel from one state to another. Are there any constitutional bases to suggest that that's legal?
There is several. There are several constitutional reasons to think that states can attach their laws and policies to people outside of state borders. One is a right to travel. Our Constitution protects individuals' rights to travel between states, among states. Another is the Dormant Commerce Clause. So that is a provision of the Constitution that forbids states from interfering with other states' rights to enter markets and to participate in interstate commerce. There's citizenship, there's full faith and credit, there's a number of other provisions that that one could invoke. But you know, I agree. I think that those have not been developed in regard to abortion. They may be powerful arguments for why Missouri, for instance, cannot punish non-Missouri providers for providing abortions to Missouri residents. But those are questions that will have to be answered by courts. And in the meantime, I think we can expect to see a lot of interstate conflict for states that seek to apply their policies outside their borders, and frankly, the states that seek to protect the people within their borders. So for example, you see California, Connecticut, New Jersey, New York, other states actively legislating to protect providers from being extradited to other states, from being subject to civil lawsuits, from being subject to subpoena, or to medical, disciplinary action. I think the post-Roe world is a really complicated one. And unlike what Justice Alito argues in the draft opinion that was leaked, we are not about to enter post-Roe America in which law is workable because it's returned to the state. We're about to enter a post-Roe country that is devastatingly complex in terms of law and in terms of access.
Robin Marty, while I think this discussion is really rich and interesting, I also think that it's the wrong discussion because when we're looking at states that are banning interstate travel, what we're doing is we're elevating this conversation to how is this going to affect the people who are the most privileged, and we're moving it away from the people who are the most vulnerable. Down here in the South, we don't talk about what this could look like if it's illegal to go to a different state because everybody already is, but also the reality is that in Alabama, where I'm running a clinic, it's impossible for our patients to get to our clinic as it is right now. In Alabama, it's a 48-hour wait, two different appointments. There's three clinics in the state. We are able to get people in within a week of them calling, but because of the overflow of people from Texas, and now this new surge from Oklahoma, where Oklahoma has banned abortion as well, in Louisiana, Mississippi, all of these states, it is impossible to get an appointment within the next 3 to 4 weeks. We're talking about people who already are finding out that they may not be able to get in for an abortion before this decision actually is announced and all of these places are no longer able to offer it. I understand that as activists, it makes us feel very, very good to have an action. And the idea of being able to move people to states where they can get care, to be able to give enough money to fly them places, to be able to give enough money to help them be able to access that abortion that they can't afford is a really important one and also makes us feel very good, frankly. But the reality is that there is no amount of money that we can provide for some people because of disability, because of age, because of the myriad of familial needs, having somebody take care of their children, their documentation status. These are all the people that are going to be left behind in this new reality. And those are the ones that we really need to figure out what is the next step and how we're going to protect.
And actually, Robin, if I can follow up, I know you've written a piece called Handbook for a Post-Roe America. So I imagine you have some thoughts on what exactly, you know, should be the next step, considering this, you know, this challenge. So where should we focus our attention, knowing that the overturning of Roe is almost assuredly coming?
So if I look at the things that I think that people can help with the most important thing that people can do is be able to focus on their own local government, especially when it comes to talking to their city councils or their city attorneys about not prosecuting people who are suspected of having done their own miscarriages. That is going to be an extremely important step, especially in red states, where we're going to see that it's not just people who are trying to terminate their own pregnancies, but the same 13 states that are going to make abortion completely illegal all across the Southeast are the same states that have refused still to expand Medicaid. These are states that have the highest poverty, have the worst maternal mortality, the lowest insurance rates. And these are people who are already having poor health outcomes because of lack of any sort of preventative care, much less prenatal care. So when we have an entire region that has no access to legal abortion, that means any person capable of becoming pregnant is instantly a suspect just by virtue of having a pregnancy that looks like it may be in some way harmed. And so we have to find ways to make sure that we as the public are standing up and saying we are not going to allow this pregnancy to be criminalized. We also have to find ways to support places that are staying open in order to provide aftercare in a realm where we are ensuring that we aren't going to turn people into the police because they can't go to their hospitals. They can't go to their doctors. They need a safe place to be. Those are the two most important things that anybody who is not worried about their own pregnancies or their own access should do in order to support others.
Lena Maria Murillo, you want to respond?
I want to both agree on with Robin and also kind of expand a little bit. I think that this notion of crossing borders, it depends on where you live. Right. So, like I said earlier, because I focus my work and I lived in El Paso, Texas, I know that crossing borders, especially into Mexico or into New Mexico, has been really important for access to care for some of the poorest people in those communities. Before Texas passed SB 8 in September, places like El Paso already had no abortion care. Right. And so oftentimes for low income folks, one of the things that they could do for people who have U.S. citizenship, of course, but underground networks exist of all kinds. People would go to the pharmacies in Juarez to get abortion medication. And so I think that these are complex conversations. And so I want to push back a little bit on suggesting that some of these are like the wrong conversations to have, but rather like there is a plurality of conversations that need to be had because these are indeed very complicated issues. And for folks who historically for a very long time have been able to use both the US and Mexico as sources for access to healthcare, the ability to or the denial of that kind of movement for some of the poorest people in our communities is going to be horrific. So I am really concerned with the ability to not be able to move to get all sorts of care. So not just abortion care. And I think I'm not in Robin's position as a provider and a chronicler of that kind of a provision of care. But I do want to say that the situation in places like El Paso that historically had a dearth of access to care, these kinds of conversations are important.
Robin, Marty, you want to respond?
I'm sorry. And yeah, Lena, I completely 100% agree with you, it especially in that border area. I know that one of the things that was really... And we talk about, obviously, the way that freedoms are on freedoms is that during, of course, the Trump administration, it was impossible for people who were in these border communities to be able to go back and forth. And so that's why when we're talking about what reproductive justice looks like, it's not just about being able to access abortion, birth control. It's about being able to access citizenship, being able to access the ability to leave your community, either to go further into the US or into Mexico. So yes, I'm sorry if it sounded like I was diminishing any of that, because you are 100% right.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing post-Roe America and women securing their reproductive rights and bodily autonomy with Rachel Rebochet of Temple University, Lena Maria Murillo of the University of Iowa, and Robin Marty of the West Alabama Women's Center. Rachel, you know, a lot of the issue here the abortion access has been framed as a privacy question. And we've been talking about this really as a question of privacy, the government's ability to be able to regulate healthcare, to be able to regulate access to certain medications, et cetera. Is that really the right approach to ensuring women's sovereignty over their bodies?
So that's a big question. I think that there are a lot of people who say no. I would be one of those people. I would agree with Robin that a crucial question at the heart of this conversation has to be, who are people seeking abortions? Why are they seeking it? And when you answer those questions, you see that it is deeply entwined with class in this country. And the lack of a safety net that people who become pregnant have in accessing the resources they need to make a meaningful decision about whether to become a parent, to have another child, and the like. And, Robin points out, for instance, the way in which we fund healthcare in this country makes that choice not a choice for many people. And so I think that privacy doesn't talk to just that issue. And I think that's what folks who are thinking about reproductive justice are thinking about. And I think that's the conscious move from talking in terms of reproductive rights, and where you're thinking about negative and positive rights that individuals hold and wield, to reproductive justice, the set of issues that occur across the life spectrum of someone's, across the reproductive life spectrum, from sex education to pregnancy to postnatal care and the like. So I think that privacy has been an impoverished term as a doctrine, does not necessarily get to some of those questions that have been at the heart of reproductive justice. I'll say that's what was really striking about reading the Alito draft, was the dismissal of any other alternative framework for supporting abortion rights under the Constitution. So he dismisses an equal protection argument in about a paragraph. And then toward the end of the opinion, just to take another example, around resources and support, it's received a lot of attention, but this conception that pregnancy in the United States is just a gift and never a burden, and it exacts no cost. And the reason it doesn't exact any cost is because we have the, Family Medical Leave Act, unpaid leave that only some people get sometimes, and that's what makes pregnancy possible. And so I think your question, gets to those types of issues and those concerns. And I'm not sure that privacy can capture all of it. Privacy, I think, is certainly meaningful for a lot of people. I think medication abortion occurs if people don't administer in a clinical space, can occur in the privacy of your home. There's something to be said about the way in which these choices do invoke, the decisions that are fundamentally important to people's self-definition. And I don't resist that they're private decisions for many, but I'm not sure it does all the work that it would need to do.
Robin, Marty, what are the different approaches to the notion of reproductive right versus reproductive justice, and the kinds of questions that each approach are going to raise to get us thinking about the best way to frame what's happening with the overturning of Roe?
So it's especially down here, and I'm going to say down here in Alabama a lot because people are always like, what's happening down in Alabama? Which, fair question. Down here, it's not as understood that we have a lack of structural, I don't want to say structural integrity, but we have a lack. Most of our societal ills are caused by the government. We live in a space where it's a reproductive justice issue that we have to pay 10% on all of our groceries. We pay 10% tax that goes into our really awful state system because they don't want to charge property taxes because property taxes are for landowners. It's basically an inherent longstanding upgrade from slave system. We have segregation that still exists that people don't know about because we don't fund our public schools. And then we send everybody who has any money sends their kids to private schools. And yes, you're going to let some Black kids into these private schools, but it's the ability to pick and choose. And then you have a failing public school system, or how our neighborhoods are essentially still segregated because we don't have mass transit. We don't have sidewalks. And so you can have a Black neighborhood right next to a white neighborhood, but they'll set up the Black neighborhood so that it's in a circle so that there's no reason you should come through it unless you are somebody who already lives there. And then you can instantly be identified if you are someone, quote unquote, not from there. So Alabama has found a way, and the South has found a way, to continue all of these structural and systematic pieces of racism. And that's where reproductive justice comes in, because it's not just about the fact that Alabama does not, in fact, have any Title X providers, except for each county has one county health department that offers free or low-cost birth control. For something that is an IUD or an implant, that means you have to wait until a doctor who is actually able to do that comes in. And our patients tell us they're waiting months to try and get in order to get birth control because they can't get it because they don't have insurance. As I said before, they don't expand Medicaid. But we also have doctors who, when patients do actually have insurance, their patients are being told, we think you should be sterilized. And when they say, you know, I don't want to be sterilized, I might want a child somewhere down the road, I'm just not ready for one at this moment, then the doctors say, if you are not prepared and you still want to have a child, then there's no reason for you to be on birth control right now. So we have system after system and layer after layer of all of these different governmental controls that are about making sure that Black and brown bodies in particular are kept into lower incomes, uneducated states, felonies constantly, and you can't reverse them so that you can get your voting rights back. All of these pieces have been fought on every level as a means of trying to keep this lower class system still in place. So that's why we keep talking about, this isn't about privacy. This is about the government trying to systematically dismantle any person's ability, if they're Black, brown, or poor, to be able to control their own lives in order to be able to do something other than just be this low income tool of the state.
And Lena Maria, I'm sure, you know, familiar with quite a bit of what Robin Marty was just, you know, describing. Love to get your thoughts on this.
Yeah. So reproductive justice is both a theoretical sort of framework and also a praxis, right? So it comes out of women of color activism of the 1980s and into the 1990s. And fundamentally, there are three main tenets to reproductive justice. One is the right to have children. The other is the right not to have children. And the third is the right to parent the children we have in safe and sustainable communities. And it's that last tenet, right, that Robin is talking about, right? It's this bigger, more holistic view of our society that makes it so that those of us who do want to have children, the hurdles, the obstacles to do so are nearly insurmountable, almost from the moment of conceiving, right? Where there are people who do not have access, for instance, to prenatal care. And so back to sort of Rachel's point, right? That that conservatives seem to just think like gestating a human being for 9 months is no big deal. It's absolutely untrue on the one hand, and on the other, the birth process in the United States is one of the most dangerous of the industrialized world, right? We have some of the highest maternal mortality rates of industrialized countries in the world. So I think that, this abortion debate is just the tip of the reproductive justice iceberg, because what it does is it opens up all of these other spaces where we say, okay, you know, fine, you know, compulsory pregnancy will be the law of the land, but where are all the other tools that we're going to need? And those are gone, right? And they've been taken away systematically, as Robin was saying, by the same people that want to institute compulsory pregnancy. So, you know, what is the Republican Party, what are conservatives going to do about bolstering the social safety net if having a baby in the US is just so easy? It's fundamentally compulsory birth, but nothing else, right? So this is the sort of that justice part of it. There's no justice in any of these laws specifically for historically marginalized communities in the US, for people of color and the poor.
This is Robin Marty.
Yeah, just following off of what Lena Maria just said, we're hearing a lot of noise right now on a federal level about, okay, well, abortion is going to be banned, but we are going to provide all these programs. That's what they're saying right now. And we know that that's not true because Texas has banned almost all abortion for the last 9 months, and they have done nothing. There has been no increase in trying to get people birth control. There has been no increase in all of these programs. It's at a point where even though more money has gone to these so-called crisis pregnancy centers that are supposed to be assisting people, we're actually at a point where crisis pregnancy centers are getting angry because they are unhappy with the clients who are coming in and then wanting these resources because they're asking for too much, or they're coming in simply to get a free ultrasound in order to see if they might still be at a point where they can get an abortion. So we know that they're not going to support, they're not going to change anything because they had the opportunity to and they never did.
When we come back, framing abortion rights and why it matters. Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Can reframing reproductive rights influence how people understand the issues related to abortion? Would the phrase reproductive justice offer a more accurate view than previous frames used, such as reproductive rights or rights to privacy? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our guests today are Rachel Rebuchet, who's the interim dean of Temple University's Beasley School of Law, Lena Maria Murillo, an assistant professor at the University of Iowa, and Robin Marty, communications director for the West Alabama Women's Center and a freelance reporter. So Rachel Rebuchet, at one level, when this draft was leaked and something that many of us have been expecting for a long time, but it's still a shock when you find out that it's actually happening, that Roe v. Wade is going to be overturned. The ultimate sort of response I know I had, and I've heard from others, is what do we do about this? I mean, at one level, this is a political question, the need to elect people who are going to ensure that we have judges that are going to respect women's reproductive rights, women's reproductive freedoms, and reproductive justice. But that's going to take some time. So in the immediate post-Roe era, what should be our focus? What should be our strategy in trying to ensure women still have access?
I think it's a big question. I think that one thing that a lot of folks have been talking about for a long time, I think it was said earlier, I believe Robin said it, that, you know, we have had for a significant amount of time regions in which abortion is not accessible. Abortion deserts, as they're called, and the focus on courts, I'm not sure, has been as productive as the focus of movements, of researchers, of lawyers, of activists on resource allocation and resource distribution, and thinking about how to put resources in the hands of communities. And so it's strategies that I think get to some of those resource questions, I think are the ones that after Roe still continue to make sense. I'll answer in another way to say that, you know, there's been a proliferation of virtual clinics that offer early abortion, medication abortion, through telehealth services. That's on the back of the change of an FDA rule that no longer requires patients to pick up medication abortion at a healthcare facility, so a clinic or the like. And what that means is that certified providers can mail medication abortion to patients. That model is also not new. Aid Access is a group that has connected people to providers in Europe and worked through a pharmacy in India to mail medication abortion to patients. So I think that in a post-Roe world in which roughly half the country seeks to ban almost all abortion or limits abortion to a significant extent, there's going to be real attention to these methods of access that for people in those states and outside those states. But to be clear, medication abortion isn't for everyone. It's only until 10 weeks of pregnancy. Many people are not candidates for it. For instance, people who have other health conditions, and as we know, people who have, because of the deep health disparities in this country, often people of color, people with low incomes, who are the majority of abortion patients nationally. So that circles back then to this question of resources and a question of what people can do to provide practical support.
And Lena Maria, on that same level, I mean, I know there's been some conversation about the so-called self-regulated or self-managed abortions, but Rachel just suggested there's only so many patients. That's not going to necessarily be applicable for everyone. So what would be some of the other strategies?
As I've been telling reporters who've been asking me similar questions, there's going to come a point where we can't talk about what those other things are, not in public spaces, right? In places like Texas, people who talk about these things and folks who are supporting the work of abortion funds that are organizations that help folks get financing, because abortions can be very expensive, especially if folks are made to wait longer and longer. They're not fielding phone calls from reporters anymore, right? I've had reporters say, I've been trying to reach so-and-so and they don't get back to me. I'm like, that's for good reason. They passed a law in the state of Texas making it illegal for them to be able to even say that they're offering support to people to get access to abortion, right? There are lots of people doing interesting things. There are abortion doulas, as Rachel said. There's a lot of telehealth happening, and likely there's going to be a proliferation of these kinds of tools. But then there's also going to come the moment where a lot of the stuff is going to go underground, and people created networks in the before times using, you know, good old fashioned telephone trees. You know, if you look at some of the folks, you know, on college campuses, women would do this a lot. So in some ways, because of the way that technology has opened the door for a lot of people, I'm interested myself to find out how these networks are coming together. I know folks who are doing things now that have asked already to please remain anonymous as they begin to do and create some of these networks. So the level of secrecy and keeping some of these new networks that are gonna proliferate, you know, that's gonna be part of our new reality.
Robin, Marty, you are in the heart of Red Country. And so I imagine you've been wrestling with this question for quite some time. But obviously, with all due respect to what Lena Maria just said about certain things you're not going to talk about, what ultimately...
Can I talk about? So everything that Lena Maria said is correct. Obviously, things exist. What we are trying to deal with right now on both a national and a local level is the idea that the same technology that allows us to be able to share this information in such an easy way is also the same technology that can get us into so much trouble, because texting, social media, all of these things, a simple email to somebody, if you're not using encrypted text messages and specialized voicemails and proton mails and all of these things, those are the things that we're thinking about right now as to how to protect ourselves. It seems like when we think about how to prepare for post-Roe America, everything that it feels we can do also comes with this double-edged sword on it. So for instance, when we talk about telemedicine and how there are a number of places that can mail pills out to people. And to be clear, these pills, as well as the pills that come from aidaccess.org, are literally the exact same regime that we do every day over and over again in our clinic. They are perfectly safe. You don't have to worry about getting the wrong sort of medication. But most of the states that are going to be the most impacted when Roe is overturned are also states where medications cannot be mailed into them. So we are seeing a proliferation of groups that are able to give medication abortion to New York, Minnesota, California, these places where there's already access. But in order for a person to, say, get medication abortion in Alabama, they would either need to ask somebody to get it for them and then mail it to them, which is prescription fraud and could get everyone in trouble. Or they can reach out to aidaccess.org where they can get the medication overseas. But all of the legal implications of this are completely on the person who is obtaining the medication. So these are all the things we have to weigh out. One of the ideas was for people to be able to access medication before they need an abortion, both because it helps with the potential lag of time that it takes for the medicine to be mailed and get through customs, but also because that way it's not tied to any sort of pregnancy. But then you have to think about certain issues like, what happens if you are a person who pre-orders medication in order to have it on hand or share with somebody else, and both sharing with somebody else is a crime, but also later on down the road, you decide you're pregnant and you do want to go ahead and give birth, but you have a miscarriage. Then what happens if those medicines are suddenly found in your house or it's realized that that's something that you did? So it's not just about what are we going to do now? It's about what will happen in 3 months. What are the repercussions 6 months down the road, a year down the road? And so we're always trying to game out what is going to be the next attack, because that's what we have to prepare everyone for.
Absolutely. And Rachel, on that front, we have what's going on now. I see messages saying, for example, the Plan B pill is available and you can buy it on Amazon. Buy a lot of them now because we don't know what's going to happen, you know, going into the future with that. So I guess part of it is what steps can be taken right now preparing for it, and then thoughts about what the next steps are.
I think that, you know, Robin and Lena Maria would know better than me, because what I've been watching and thinking about are, you know, as a lawyer, I've been thinking about the piece of policy that could either impede or advance some of the work being done in these spaces. And I don't hear a ton of people talking about it, but the telehealth policies of states that vary state to state, there's no national law, there's no uniform code. It's really placed in standard of care driven. And it makes a difference to some of these questions of access. So that's one piece that, if you are, you know, thinking about this in terms of statute, policy, and care. Another piece of this is thinking about how to protect providers' licenses and how to think about the pros and cons of cross-border licensure. That has been a real pro, it seems, for distributing care across the country where it's permitted. 19 states, for instance, as Robin suggested, do not allow any kind of telehealth for abortion. And having someone who can prescribe from Maine to New Mexico covers a lot of ground, but you know, there might be also jurisdictional reasons to have, if you have a license in an unfriendly state, you know, what kind of jurisdiction can that state then insert over you in a post-Roe country? So that's another, you know, discrete example.
And if I could follow up, are there legal funds? I know a lot of what's likely, you know, to develop in the next year or two, you know, perhaps a little bit longer, are going to be a number of legal cases where activists, where individuals are going to be charged with different crimes because of, you know, trying to protect these rights. Are there legal initiatives? Are there legal funds? Are there individuals that, you know, those of us thinking, okay, we need to put resources towards this. We want to make sure people have, at a minimum, the best representation that they can when they face these.
Yeah. So that's why I would look to providers, because I was talking to a provider yesterday, for example, about advanced provision of medication abortion, and the, you know, this kind of what's been referenced as the double-edged sword, you know, wanting to think about creative ways to help people across the country, no matter where they live, but also thinking about what might be the liability and the risk that providers face. For instance, there's a project Period Pills, thinking about how medications that are used for medication abortion also can start a period, menstrual regulation. And what are the, you know, what are providers thinking about in terms of those provisions? But I think, as just mentioned, I'm not a provider. I'm a legal academic. And so I've got, you know, and I worry about writing things down and saying things that, you know, put a spotlight on what people are doing on the ground when they're going to bear the cost, when they're the targets. And that's a big concern of mine. Someone's not going to show up at my university necessarily. You know, that would be a very rare instance if someone walks into Klein Hall at Temple and, you know, tries to sue me, but someone is going to try to sue Robin.
Go off of what Rachel just said. One of the biggest issues that I hear from my providers are the fact that once a doctor has any issue with their license in one state, that throws them off in any state. So we had to fight to get our doctor's license back for a wrongful accusation against her. And it took us 8 months in order to actually get it all the way through the medical board. It cost $120,000 for her to defend herself. But the most important part of it was the fact that she would have lost her New Mexico license as well. So when you have providers, and especially in the South, most people who are providing abortions right now do not live in the South. There, it is very rare to have an abortion provider who lives down here and actually provides care all the time. Usually they travel in, it's the same bunch of doctors. They go from clinic to clinic to clinic, and they make a circuit. They're called circuit riders. So they have licenses in all these other places that they need to protect. And the reason that this is so devious and so frightening is because if you ask a doctor, okay, would you go to jail to provide an abortion? Most doctors would probably say yes and just take it. But if you ask a doctor, would you give up all of your ability to ever practice medicine again forever? They can't do that. It's their love and it's their livelihood, and they get scared. As for the what to do to protect people legally, there's an organization called If, When, How, which is the place to go when it comes to protecting people who have pregnancies that are being investigated. If, When, How has launched what's known as a reproductive legal help fund. So they have a line that exists for people who go into hospitals and are being questioned. They have a bail fund that they have set up that's specifically for people who have been jailed. Recently, there was Herrera, I'm totally blanking on her name, in McAllen, Texas, who was
Nissen.
Yes, thank you.
It's the Repro Legal Defense Fund, just for listeners who want to Google the name.
And by the way, we will post some of these links to the show page so you're able to track this down. But Robin, we cut you off.
I talk too much. You can cut me off.
And Lena Maria, I keep hearing stories then about these, you know, prosecutions, or I guess not necessarily prosecutions, but definitely, you know, medical practices. Just saw one today where there was an indication of an unwillingness on the part of doctors to prescribe certain types of medications for women having, you know, troubled pregnancies, miscarriages, et cetera, under SB8, you know, in Texas. And so I guess, you know, broadly, again, I know, you know, this has been a part of the conversation, and it certainly seems very real. These types of prosecutions seem to be very real. Is this something that's becoming more common in Texas?
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, NPR did a great kind of investigative report on that not so long ago that was investigating, you know, oftentimes these conversations are framed within the sort of scope of people who want to plan to end their pregnancy, right? But of course, there are people who want to stay pregnant and, you know, want to go through the process. It's a wanted birth. And, you know, there's all kinds of issues that can arise. And so in a place like Texas, it's making really hard for doctors to speak openly because, you know, they feel as though they're working sort of within the shadow of this issue. And so when situations come up for people where abortion would be, you know, under different circumstances would be an option to consider, right? If there are malformations with the fetus, or if they're, you know, that could cause the pregnant person. And I should say, we've been saying woman a lot, but there are pregnant people, right? There are trans and non-binary people. There are men that get pregnant. And so I think, you know, that's part of the reproductive justice, you know, discussion also, right? Is that we need to, you know, gender is a construct and we need to think beyond it. But of course, historically, these issues have very much affected women and continue to affect women, but certainly our larger queer community and non-binary trans community. These things are really troubling and quite frightening for folks who want to proceed or who are, you know, wanting to proceed with their pregnancy, but because of other health issues and their doctors or medical providers do not feel comfortable. So one of my mentors, who's a sociologist, Dr. Carol Jaffe out of UCSF, wrote a New York Times op-ed not that long ago, sort of centering these specific issues. What happens when there are legitimate health risks to the person who's carrying this pregnancy and wants to carry the pregnancy to term? There's so much gray, and they have completely taken the ability for medical professionals to talk openly and honestly to their patients. This to me seems, you know, an affront to the notion that the folks who are imposing these laws are in favor of you know, life, because they are putting millions of people's lives, sentient people's lives, at risk by denying access to conversations about people's health care.
Yeah. Robin, Marty, you want to respond?
Everything that Lena Maria said, I feel like I should just keep saying over and over again, everything that Lena Maria says, but I don't think it can be made more crucially clear how much abortion restrictions in general undermine the doctor-patient relationship in every single level. I want to say 2013, Arizona passed a law that, among other things, protected doctors from being sued if they refused to tell their patients that there was a fetal anomaly because they were afraid that the patient would seek out an abortion. And speaking in a very personal level, I spoke to people who would reach out to me because I was always the person that knew where an abortion clinic was. And they would come to me and say, can you help me find an ultrasound? Because I think there might be something wrong and I don't trust my doctor. And that's where they were. It wasn't, I'm necessarily going to have an abortion. It's, I'm at risk for Downs. I do not know for sure if that is what's going on here, but I can't trust my doctor to tell me the truth because I know that he does not approve of abortion. These are the things that are undermining all the medical systems. It's the reason why ACOG, the Association of Gynecologists, comes out against these sort of restrictions in all forms, even though, and it's also the reason why we have so many medical professionals now who don't know how to do basic gynecological care. And I cannot emphasize how badly we see this in Alabama and Mississippi, where we have patients who come to us all of the time for a miscarriage management simply because there aren't doctors who know how to do a DNC at their hospitals. This is only going to get worse. And so it's just another one of those things where it's not about the people who can't get abortions all the time either. It's about any person capable of becoming pregnant.
And Robin, Marty, I mean, what you're saying there is reminding me of data that we've been presenting for a number of years now about the rising maternal mortality rates across the country, but in particular in certain regions in the country that are resembling global South countries. When you think about the wealth the United States has, to have that maternal mortality rate, it seems to be pretty closely tied, if not directly correlated with abortion policy from the states.
It's definitely tied with abortion policy. It's also tied with contraception policy and the lack of it. It's tied, as we say, all of these things are tied together. If you look at Mississippi and Alabama, 50% of all pregnancies are unplanned. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're unwanted, but those are all unplanned pregnancy. The person did not intend to get pregnant at that time. And so when we know that one of the most common reasons that we have maternal mortality issues are pregnancies that are too closely spaced together, or pregnancies that happen when a person does not have prenatal care, which is something that happens when they don't know that they're going to get pregnant, they're not intending to get pregnant. These are all the different pieces that are causing us to have a health crisis that is literally killing, especially Black women in the South.
And I will add, even though my focus and my research is mostly on the U.S.-Mexico border, I live in the state of Iowa, and the state of Iowa has the horrific distinction of having the highest maternal mortality rate per capita for Black women. We have a very, you know, this is a very white state. You know, there are scholars here, one of my dear friends in public health, Nicole Novak, has been doing incredibly interesting work looking at undocumented communities and migrant communities in meatpacking regions in places like Iowa, where there have been major immigrant raids that have then gone on to create horrible effects for pregnant people. And so, again, to get back to this idea of reproductive justice, there's these ripple effects that compound the dearth of access to healthcare that people already are living under, right? So to be forced to birth in a country that from the second you become pregnant makes it absolutely the most rigorous, horrific process to even get basic access to prenatal care. As somebody who myself, you know, I had children. As a graduate student, I had no healthcare. I was in California, but they, my goodness, Medi-Cal made it really hard. And so, and I have citizenship, right? So imagine folks who are undocumented or at the very margins of our society. It is a gauntlet to access basic healthcare, let alone prenatal care. So, you know, these all of these issues that you're bringing up come back to that, right? So this sort of the systemic compounding of loss of care.
This is Robin, Marty.
And that's another place where you can point to the fact that people are claiming to be pro-life, but aren't doing the supports that are necessary. It was 2011, and the state of Nebraska had a fight over whether undocumented women who were pregnant should still be allowed to have health insurance. And the argument was, of course, their children would be citizens, but this was the height of the Tea Party revolution. And so they're like, we don't want to do anything for immigrants. So they're trying to steal health care by getting pregnant with these anchor babies was the actual argument that they were using. Like, Nebraska at that time, their state motto was the good life. And like, they embraced that. And yet here they're saying, you know, I know it's going to save us money in the end, but we don't want people to have health care. And there were so many people that I talked to when I was writing my book the first time from the Latina community who said that for people who are new to the country or undocumented, being pregnant was literally the only time that they had access to health care because that was the only time anybody cared about them.
I think what we draw from this conversation as this one draws to a close is, first of all, you can think of it as shifting the discourse, but I think it's about broadening the discourse. At its core, I was really struck by the protests and the chant that abortion is healthcare, and that healthcare is at its core, certainly it's a rights question, but it absolutely is a justice question and at the core of what really is a protection of life. And so if we draw from what is really a trauma of the overturning of Roe v. Wade and the loss of bodily autonomy, it's that the need to broaden this discourse and be far more inclusive certainly is valuable. And quite frankly, I think it's fair to say the fight has always been there. The fight continues and the fight absolutely intensifies as a result of these political developments. We've been discussing what women will do, what women must do, and what we as a society should do to ensure that women have reproductive sovereignty, autonomy over their bodies in a post-Roe world. Our guests today have been Rachel Ribble-Shea, the interim dean of Temple University's Beasley School of Law and the James E. Beasley Professor of Law, and she's the author of a new publication, The New Abortion Battleground. Lena Maria Murillo, assistant professor at the University of Iowa. She is the author of Fighting for Control, Power, Reproductive Care, and Race in the U.S.-Mexico Borderlands. And Robin Marty, the communications director for the West Alabama Women's Center and a freelance reporter, and the author of Handbook for a Post-Roe America and the co-author of The End of Roe v. Wade. Thank you all for joining us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.